you for coming tonight. It's kind of an emotional situation for me because this is the first time I've been back at Yale since graduation in 72. So it is a moving situation for me. What have I been doing since 1972? I've been on every continent of the world for over 3 decades, traveling extensively. Of course, not Antarctica, but I've seen many exotic situations. I've done undercover work in former communist bloc in Eastern Europe, and also in China 20 years ago when things were much more difficult than now. So I've seen the far corners of the earth, and today's topic is very interesting because it involves indeed the state of the earth and how we can actually respond. First, I'd like to talk about response, because what we're dealing with is an extraordinary inertia in human society, almost like a mass consensual trance. Or, if you want to state it even more baldly, a suicidal impulse in terms of humanity's relationship with the environment. My point is that we need to look at, we need to consider completely different ways of dealing with the human problem. Ways that aren't considered mainstream yet in Western society. Let's look at yoga. Generally, when people think of yoga, they think of physical postures and breathing exercises. And yes, that has a place. That's at the very beginning of the yoga system. We all need good health. And certainly, any endeavor to improve our health is welcome. But that's just the beginning of the yoga system. The yoga system actually deals with connectivity and especially the ultimate connection. Connectivity doesn't simply involve matter and material actions and reactions. Connectivity involves consciousness. Now, consciousness is a mysterious subject from the viewpoint of Western science. I was speaking at New York University last night and Columbia University last week, and in discussing with the students, I explained that, well, if you're a neoclassical neuroscientist, you don't even talk about consciousness. There's no such thing because it doesn't show up on any scientific instruments. It can't be quantified. But if you're less stubborn than a neoclassic neuroscientist, you'll admit consciousness is a mystery. If we can just hypothetically take consciousness out of the matter category, that opens up a whole realm of new connections, and indeed, I would say, the most profound connections. I'm speaking tonight from the viewpoint of the top of the yoga ladder. The bottom of the yoga ladder begins with physical postures and breathing exercises. Most people don't even know what the real purpose of that regimen is. It's not just to lose weight. It's not just to have flexible muscles. The purpose of the physical postures and the breathing exercises is to calm your mind, make your mind peaceful, so that you can focus on what is the ultimate goal of life. And that's just the beginning of the yoga system. having a peaceful mind to focus on the ultimate goal of life. From that level, the yoga system moves on up. And at the top of the yoga ladder is connection to the ultimate source. That is the goal of the bhakti yoga system. Connecting through pure consciousness. Pure consciousness meaning pure devotion to the ultimate source of consciousness. That's where the term Krishna consciousness comes from. So, if you can somehow or other shift Western society onto another track, get the train onto another track, then you might have a great chance of changing the present course of humanity's interaction with the environment. If we look at the ancient Krishna text, Bhagavad Gita, known throughout the world as one of the greatest religious classics, but if we don't look at it as simply a religious text, but as a handbook for procedures, how to interact with the cosmos, we could gain a lot of insight. For example, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna talks about the body as being a city of 9 gates. The exact Sanskrit is Navadvaram Pura Dehi. You, the unit of consciousness, you as your core identity of non-material, you dwell in a body which can be considered to have 9 gates. It's like a city, 9 gateways to the city. 2 eyes, 2 nostrils, a mouth, 2 ears, anus, and genital. So through those gates, you ride out and interact with the environment around you. The body, of course, that city of 9 gates is an environment. And then there's the wider environment that you participate in. So the whole point of bhakti yoga, or Krishna consciousness, is how to interact with the environment in a way that facilitates the ultimate goal of life. This is very important. It's very pragmatic. It redefines, this purpose redefines our reason for being in this world. We're not here to consume. We're not here to exploit nature. We're not here to just be passive and let things happen. We are here to achieve an ultimate goal. That ultimate goal, enlightenment, complete spiritualization, has 2 levels. The first level is to understand that you have a spiritual identity, a non-material identity. The second level is to understand that you are part of a greater spiritual identity, and that there's a relationship between the two, between the finite and the infinite. If we can shift human society onto a track in which higher consciousness goals are the main quest, you lighten the ecological impact of human society. And how to lighten the ecological impact of human society is the greatest issue of the day. For example, by now, everyone knows the economic research that beyond a basic middle-class standard of living, increased income doesn't lead to increased happiness. This is well known now. The past 10 years, that research has been out there. Increased income, increased acquisition of consumer goods beyond a certain basic level does not lead to an increase in measured happiness, according to psychological parameters. So, knowing that, do you think intelligent people are rushing to simplify their life. I speak at universities all over the world, and I always ask the students, all right, I ask the professors too, how many of you are content to live at a basic middle class standard? No one raises their hands. I said, you know the research. What's going on? There's a disconnect between what our intelligence tells us and our lifestyle. We're really stuck in a rut. There's a lot of habit energy that's molding our life. So how to break that crust? In order to break that crust, I'm advocating a completely different way of life. I think now is the time to start considering that we need a completely different way of life. And therefore, I think it's a good time that people consider living according to the yoga science of antiquity. Because it's not just about physical postures and losing weight. It's about how you connect with everything around you. And your connecting with everything around you has to take into account your connection with the ultimate source. Let me give you a recent example that just came out 2 days ago. Scientific research that just hit the press 2 days ago. To show you how much inertia, how much resistance to change people have, even though the facts are right in front of their eyes. Many of you may know that in 2006, just 3 years ago, the UN published a very startling report, Livestock's Long Shadow, which presented that 18% of the global warming problem is caused by the livestock industry, the meat industry. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that co-chaired the Nobel Prize, their chairman made the statement that obviously then reducing the meat diet is the most attractive immediate option for dealing with global warming. And he also added, we're afraid to say this. We are afraid to say this, but this is the truth. All right, that was 2006. Now, just 2 days ago, two World Bank environmental scientists have contested that 18% statistic. They say it's actually 51%. That means more than the emissions caused by industry and transport combined. Now, this news of 2 days ago is no doubt going to set off a firestorm. It's going to be controversial. But these World Bank environmental scientists are prepared to take their stand and further underline the point that the easiest way to deal with global warming, the most effective way, is to change people's diets. That is a much more effective way than even replacing fossil fuels with renewable fuels. Now, what do you think? Do you think people are going to buy into this? Their habits are so strong. I present the yoga system to you, particularly the bhakti yoga system, because something more powerful and comprehensive than what Western society knows now is necessary to kind of turn the ship around and revamp people's lifestyles. More recent news, a couple of weeks ago, a very reputable polling agency discovered that the percentage of Americans who believe in global warming has plummeted this year, 17% from last year. In spite of all the media discussion and scientific discussion, the number of persons who accept that global warming is a problem has plummeted. So what's going on with people? Why do they have such inertia? Why do they have such resistance? We need to look at that point and how to do something about it if we're actually going to be able to benefit humanity. There's some reason why there's so much inertia, so much we're stuck in the mud. So what to do?
Excuse me?
Yes, may please, I? Come on in.
Thank you. Excuse me.
If we look at our population situation. Now, at the beginning of the 19th century, there were just 1 billion people on this earth. 100 years later, right before World War II, there's 2 billion people on the earth. Now, fast forward less than 100 years to where we are now, and there's close to 7 billion people. I know most of you plan to be around by the middle of this century, at which time, most likely, the world will add the equivalent of 2 Chinas to its present population. So, that's just the beginning of very critical drivers that are influencing our situation. You have the numbers of human beings. Although the eminent and emeritus Harvard biologist Edward O. Wilson says, he gives a very nice thought experiment. He says, you can take all the human beings on the planet now and put them in a cubic box 1.6 cubic miles, and you can just stick that box in a remote corner of the Grand Canyon, and all the human beings are out of the way. Alright. It's a thought experiment, obviously. In reality, it can't happen. So, you have the numbers, then you have the impact of technology. Practically speaking, all the most crucial technological advancements have been the past 100 years, generally speaking. Then you have hyperconsumption, God's gift to humanity. That hyperconsumption, as you know, is so addictive that the developing world has accepted it as a model for how to live. And then you have the global market. How convenient it is to look at the world as one market. And then you have the economy of scale. If everyone eats the same, you can mass produce your processed food in such a way that everyone will buy what you want because everyone wants the same thing. Population, technology, hyperconsumption, and the global market. Together, these have combined to make such a threat to our own habitat. What is so powerful that can change the course this train is heading on? I very much appreciate the conclusion by the Dean of Yale School of Environment and Forestry, Dr. Speth, who says, look, the only thing that's going to work is a massive change in consciousness. A groundswell movement which takes into account scientists, poets, philosophers, musicians, politicians. Everyone has to jump on board and make a contribution to changing the consciousness of human society. I agree with that. The consciousness is the crucial issue. But then you have to understand, what is consciousness? And give people an alternative. What do I do with my consciousness if it's not immersed in material expansion and hyperconsumption? Is there something else to do with my consciousness? You have to understand what consciousness is. So the yoga system, particularly the bhakti yoga system, teaches us that just like the sun pervades the universe with light, similarly, the non-material particle of consciousness pervades the body. Our non-material core being pervades the body with consciousness. If we can accept that consciousness is non-material, then naturally we'll be motivated to look to non-material methods for satisfying ourselves. So this is where the action gets quite dynamic. Non-material methods of satisfaction. If we can mass distribute non-material methods for satisfying the conscious self, we can actually shift people off the path towards constantly increasing their environmental impact, even though everyone else says, even though scientists say, look, it can't go on like that. But it is going on like this. A little tinkering here, a little tinkering there. As you know, there's even difficulty just passing a lukewarm climate change legislation. What to do? I'm advocating a complete change in the worldview of our society. What will give us the willpower and impact power to actually live a different way? We have to investigate that now. There's no doubt about it. We don't have any other options open. Let's look at the situation from another point of view. Is climate change, global warming, is that the problem, or is it symptomatic of a deeper problem? You can make a longer list. There's global warming, there's nuclear proliferation in the Middle East, there's water shortage. All these, I would say, are symptomatic. Now, we can analyze the problem at the root at different levels. Symptomatic of what? What is global warming symptomatic of? Wouldn't it be more precise to say that our environmental problems are symptomatic of economic and social institutional failure? Wouldn't that start to finger the real culprit? Our institutions, our economic and social institutions can't actually get human beings to change. Wouldn't that be the naked truth? Let's look at the political system. I like the statement, the analysis given by our recently failed presidential candidate. He said, look, what do you expect politicians to do about climate change? Politicians deal with issues. That means things in your face. When we talk about issues, we mean things that are pushing right against you right now. He said, but climate change, it's not pushing in your face. The man on the street is thinking, where's the money? When's the recession going to end? Where's my job? He's not, the average person's not thinking, oh, climate change, what to do? And then, when the issue of climate change is right in your face, John McCain said, it's too late. So, he said, what do you want out of us? We're damned if we do, damned if we don't. So, since there's no way out of this conundrum, better just ignore the whole thing. obviously, we probably won't agree with that conclusion. But it was a very pragmatic analysis of the situation he gave, why the political system is logjam. And recently, as I pointed out earlier, the polls have shown that less Americans believe global warming is a problem this year than last year. So we're not going forward, we're going backwards. Okay, so if we accept environmental problems as symptomatic of social and economic institutional failure, we're starting to then get a grip on the real criminal. Our society is functioning in such a way that a problem has to show up in this financial quarter or the next financial quarter. Or in this year of a politician's office or the next year. Long term, that means more than 20 years. Who wants to deal with that? Our institutions aren't geared actually for dealing with long term effects. Long term meaning 20 years. A common assumption is that we have inherited the world from our parents. It would be more precise to say we've borrowed the world from our children. Just that shift in understanding would free up our thinking process a bit. We've borrowed the world from our children. So, what can get into our core being that will cause us to walk our talk? This is the big problem now. So, in my talks around the world, at universities around the world, I advocate the Bhakti Yoga system based on the prime yoga text, Bhagavad Gita, as a way to distribute non-material fulfillment. I advocate that as the crying need of the day. By distributing non-material fulfillment, you take the heat off the earth, literally and metaphorically. People are so pent up with their, in yoga talk we'd say, material desires. Desires to be happy by exploiting matter, because they think they are matter. So it makes sense. I'm matter. There's matter all around. Our connectivity is matter to matter. But if you, by the grace of the yoga system, conceive of yourself as a non-material entity, naturally, you start to consider non-material methods of fulfillment. The more that we can create a groundswell of at least the public's considering this non-material fulfillment, the more you'll actually be able to see some impetus for change. But right now, that impetus for change is quite lacking, embarrassingly so. You know as well as I what we are up against. I like to read some religious quotes. I'll just give you one from the Religion of Consumerism. Right after World War II, you know the USA had a huge industrial facility for the war effort. It seemed obvious. Now the war's over. Let's put all that industrial capacity into consumption. A very reputed retailing analyst at that time, Victor Lebeau, stated things quite devotionally with much evangelical fervor. Our enormously productive economy demands that we make consumption our way of life, that we convert the buying and use of goods into rituals that we seek our spiritual satisfaction, our ego satisfaction in consumption. We need things consumed, burned up, worn out, replaced, and discarded at an ever-increasing rate. Obviously, Western society took this platitude, beatitude, quite seriously. And planned obsolescence is just a fact of life. Doesn't end there, though. What about the constant search for potential markets? That also takes on a quasi-religious aura. Here's a statement by the president of Coca-Cola regarding Indonesia. Anyone here from Indonesia? This is the president of Coca-Cola. When I think of Indonesia, a country of 180 million people on the equator with a median age of 18 years old and a Muslim ban on alcohol, when I think of all that, I know what heaven is. So you see, there's a quasi-religious attachment and dedication about our current materialistic situation. The only way I feel that you can combat that so that we can actually improve our dreadful situation is to actually deal with the self in a non-material way. I'm for a broadly based coalition of efforts to advocate the non-material self and the non-material fulfillment of the non-material self. In particular, I present the jewel of the yoga system, the bhakti yoga system, connecting to the supreme consciousness through pure consciousness as the life's main goal. I'd like to quote from you from one of the Upanishads called the Ishopanishad. In Sanskrit, Isha means controller or proprietor. So this Upanishad particularly deals with the issue of the ultimate proprietor and how human beings are meant to deal with resources according to the plan of the ultimate proprietor. So there we find a very interesting Sanskrit verse in the Isha Upanishad. It states, Ishavasham idam sarvam. Everything is owned and controlled by the Supreme Consciousness. And human beings are entitled to only accept whatever resources they require for living a simple life of enlightenment and nothing more. So in other words, human beings, according to the Isha Upanishad, are allotted resources simply for a life of enlightenment. That's it. This is a main tenet of the Bhakti Yoga system. If we look at our life and our purpose in this world in terms of the goal of enlightenment, we say Krishna consciousness, awareness of our relationship with the ultimate consciousness, then you're not striving to satisfy yourself in so many destructive ways. You don't have crazy consumer needs. And because you're living properly in harmony with nature, because you're living according to the ultimate purpose, you're not such a disturbance in this world. In conclusion, I'd like to say that particularly I feel justified after more than three decades of traveling the world on every continent since I graduated from Yale, I feel justified now in publicly advocating the jewel of the yoga system and bhakti yoga, because I don't see that there's a strong enough impetus in Western society for changing the dynamics. And therefore, I think we need to consider other options, other avenues. I remember back in 1972, after I graduated, vegetarianism was considered quite strange. When I became a vegetarian, my parents were like, "You're gonna die." My goodness, what's happening to our boy? To tell you the truth, I'm embarrassed to say, my father didn't tell me this till 20 years later, after I graduated. He was trying to get me committed to a mental institution because I had become a vegetarian. My mother wouldn't sign, and both parents had to sign according to New York law. So my mom instead of mom because I'm based in Australia, New Zealand. So my mom, she couldn't do that to her eldest son. My boy's just graduated from Yale University. Now his father wants to commit him to a mental institution because he's a vegetarian. All right, thank God for a mother's soft heart. I remember concepts like karma were considered exotic. Now, whether people know exactly what karma means according to the yoga texts or not, it's just considered, part of everyday parlance. People just joke, "I guess it's my karma, I flunked my exam," or something like that. So, if we can make such a shift in society that what was considered very weird in the 70s is now considered an everyday affair, why can't we start considering the real purpose of the yoga system? Yoga was quite unknown in the 70s. Now everyone understands, it's about exercise, it's about losing weight, it's about breathing better, it's about calming your nerves. As I pointed out earlier in tonight's presentation, that's just the beginning of the yoga system. Remember, the purpose of the physical postures and the breathing is to calm your mind. Calm your mind for what? So that you can go on consuming more, making more money, and damaging the earth? No, calming your mind so you can focus on what is the ultimate goal of life. You can focus on non-material fulfillment. That's the purpose of these yoga asanas. But that purpose has not yet permeated our society, but we have to start somewhere. So, in conclusion, I feel justified to present a completely different avenue. But then again, it's not a totally different avenue when you consider that the goal of all spiritual processes is more or less non-material fulfillment. I advocate the yoga system because it is process. I think you say process here, though. It's a process it has clear-cut methodology, and the goal is clear-cut. How do you live in the city of nine gates? Remember, in the beginning I described Bhagavad Gita's verse, Krishna speaks, Navam Dwaram Pure Dehi. The yogi lives peacefully in the city of nine gates. The nine gates, once again, two eyes, two nostrils, mouth, two ears, anus, genital. The yogi knows how to live in that body, which is a city of nine gates, and not make a mess of things in terms of the body, in terms of the mind, and in terms of the external environment. So if we remember the Ishopanishad, the Upanishad of ultimate control and proprietorship, and if we remember the injunction given therein, you have a right to utilize the resources of this world only to the extent for living a life geared to non-material fulfillment. Whatever resources are required for that goal, you're allotted and no more. I think this message has tremendous value for society today. So I'm going to stop here, and perhaps you may have some questions. As I said in the beginning, it is a quite emotional night for me because this is the first time I've returned to Yale since graduation.